Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Welcome back to a Midsummer's Tailgate. I am Terry Foy, joined by the Honorable Nick Osello, who's getting up early for us on a Friday. Nick, this is going to be the funnest podcast we've ever recorded. I have zero doubt about it. We have a lot to discuss. I think you and I both fell into a common summer trap of traveling too much in order to stay on top of all the content that would have otherwise been discussion worthy. And we are going to talk about our respective experiences at the World Championship, including some of the most notable storylines that occurred. But first, because time is a linear thing, we have to talk about what happened more recently. And the simple fact is that what unfolded on Twitter, the imploding hellscape of Elon Musk's recreation, over the course of the last 5 days is eminently interesting. And I'm not really that interested in talking about the specific details. I'm more interested in talking about the notion of breaking news in theory, because it's something that you have an acute relationship with, specifically when it comes to this conversation, as well as something that, you know, I've kind of been working on over the course of the last 15 years. But in order to set the table for the listeners who are otherwise unacquainted, Krzysztof Strzemski, who is a researcher for TNT, largely working on their hockey programming, is a Syracuse alum who was close with the program while he was there working with their video analytics department. And he is a notable voice in lax Twitter, for lack of a better way of putting it. After graduating from Syracuse, he worked in a similar type of capacity in the production side at ESPN, and was heavily involved in ESPN lacrosse as well. He doesn't like work necessarily, so to speak, for a lacrosse publication, but he has a really nice source network that gets him a lot of information, and he posts about it on Twitter, whether it be transfers or primarily coach movement in this kind of summertime offseason. On Saturday, he posted about Dave Petromala's move from Syracuse, from being the Syracuse, the defensive coordinator at Syracuse, to taking on the same role at North Carolina. Big news. And you know, credit to him for that scoop. I didn't know that it was happening when it happened. If there's an opportunity, we can talk a little bit more about the things that have gone on, the four sequences that have occurred at North Carolina from a reshuffling their coaching staff deck that got us to this point. But again, you know, this conversation, I think, is going to be more interesting if we're talking about theory than we are talking about the specific details. So then, later on, since then, in the wake of that, he, I believe it was Monday, posted a tweet naming five candidates for the defensive coordinator position for Syracuse, and candidate might be too strong of a term. You know, it's probably worth it to pull up the actual phrasing of it. But that being said, I will do so. But the most pertinent element was he named Joe Amplo in this list of five candidates, and the Navy head coach replied within about a half hour to that original tweet, questioning the sources and saying that he was very happy in his job and he was looking to continue there. And then Ty Zanders, who works for Inside Lacrosse, and if you're listening to this podcast, you surely know who he is, made a joke about the nature of the list subsequent to that. I thought you, and I shared this phrasing, I think, is worthwhile. Tone perfect. I thought you tone perfectly diffused, for lack of a better word, the situation, taking on the role of Twitter judge in order to adjudicate this case. I think anybody who follows you would know that you, I think it's fair to say, pulled some punches. You could have been a little bit more aggressive when it came to some of the jokes that you could have made in assessing and adjudicating this situation. But at the same time, again, you know, I want to summarize your point of view on the whole situation. But at the same time, I also want to kind of dive into your experience in this realm of breaking lacrosse news on Twitter, what it means, why people do it, and what the stakes are, because you have I guess it's, for lack of a better word, a unique relationship to the experience of doing so. as I said, I think it's important to specifically read Yastrzemski's tweet that kind of got this conversation started. So the main names, myself and Brent, referring to Syracuse reporter Brent Axe, with whom he was about to go on the radio, have heard in alphabetical order: Joe Amplo, Ron Caputo, Travis Crane, John Galloway, and Ryan Wellner. So with that context, why did you take on the role of Twitter judge in order to adjudicate this online controversy?
Someone photoshopped a pretty good picture of my face in a judge position, and I was like, ooh, I like that. And that was pretty much the extent of it. I was like, okay, if someone took the time to photoshop and make me look cool sitting on a judge podium, I'm going to lean into that bit. So that was about as much thought that went into, okay, I want to play Twitter judge. And what better case than the dumbest case of all time, which is lacrosse breaking news. I think lacrosse breaking news is one of the ultimate rock and a hard place situations, because it's either, oh, hey, that's cool, or what an idiot, what a complete total jackass. This guy was wrong about something. He should really leave society. So what the weirdest part of this to me was Amplo taking a shot. And I'm going to use his name that I know him by, which is Jazz Pastrami. His last name's a nightmare, but he's awesome. I will never be able to pronounce his last name right, but he's one of the funniest guys, I think, out there. He has stupid bits. He's active with a bunch of stuff that I do, and objectively hilarious. And the weird part to me was Amplo saying in his response, where he was like, yeah, I'm actually not interested in the job. Hope you got the likes and the clicks and the shares that you were looking for. I'm like, are we trying to take ourselves seriously as a sport, or are we not? And to me, there's no dumber or stupider example than breaking lacrosse Twitter news. Because again, it goes back to, it's either, oh, dang, that's cool. Okay, anyways, I'm going to go back to the beach. Or it's a chance to dogpile on somebody who, quote-unquote, incorrectly broke the news. So the entire persona of becoming a judge, and when you say I hit the tone correctly and perfectly, that is years of Thanksgivings and Christmases with a Republican father and with Democratic sisters. So I've been towing this line of tone. I just haven't had the chance to unleash it yet. So this was a fun one. Both guys involved are nice people. And the big distinction, and I actually want to get your opinion on this, because for how involved I am in lacrosse, sometimes I just don't know things that I immediately insert myself into, which is the beauty of Twitter. We're all just spraying shit against the wall and not knowing what's going on. But Amplo very well may have been a name that was considered by Syracuse, and whether or not he was interested, maybe that's what Jazz Pastrami heard, where he was just like, hey, we're hearing they're targeting Amplo. Is that fair? Like, is that journalistic integrity if Syracuse is interested in Amplo to kind of tweet that out, as opposed to, well, Amplo needs to receive that relatively well before that should be even posted publicly?
All right, so before I answer that question, let me just kind of reel all the way back to share my perspective on this whole conversation. And not specifically, again, this conversation, just the notion of breaking news. So, you know, first, to kind of define Inside Lacrosse as an organization, we are a lacrosse media company that practices journalism. We are not a purely journalistic outfit. We are not a daily newspaper. We are not a newspaper of record. And that is something that was kind of an established brand position prior to my arrival, and something that I was kind of raised within or came up and developed within my career to do. And then, you know, certainly something that I understand the merits of, you know, continuing as the leader of the organization. And the core distinction, and the reason that I think that distinction is important for Inside Lacrosse, is because we advocate for the sport. And if we were a purely journalistic outfit, that would be improper. That would fall outside the boundaries of what classically trained journalists are meant to do. The advocacy for the sport is, you know, hugely impactful in you know, creating our point of view. we want lacrosse to grow. We want lacrosse to be embraced by more communities. We want lacrosse to be accessible to everybody who wants to access lacrosse. That is personally like kind of my guiding light. You know, I say all the time, like I didn't have the opportunity to play lacrosse in middle school because it didn't exist where I was from. So I've experienced wanting to play and not being able to. And that is like kind of the core driving factor or force in how I approach this job. When I say we practice journalism, it means that on a story-to-story basis, it is appropriate to apply principles that the members of our staff were taught, you know, in college or whatever, or do, you know, practiced doing, you know, in preparation for these roles, and then you do the best that you can. I think that like journalism and media is one of the most polarizing topics in our culture because there are some things that are so able to be debated that in the same like political science, you already made this comment, is like it is inherently to be debated about. What I think that a lot of folks don't understand, and I'm not saying that this is like a like universally held truism, but journalism is a social science practiced by human beings. Invariably, there will be tons of incorrectness and inaccuracies. I think that the core distinction between the term fake news and earnest media that is incorrect is your starting point intention, right? And I think that to your earliest comment about taking yourself seriously versus taking the thing that you do seriously, like that is the core distinction between like a happy person and somebody who's probably going to struggle to find happiness if they wrap their identity too much into their job. When this saga was going on, I was having a conversation about our recruiting rankings or having a conversation about our coverage of the World Championship with people who were actually involved. And, you know, my comment was like, it is our responsibility to take the content seriously because our readership takes the content seriously. But as soon as we start taking ourselves too seriously, then we become a punching bag for people who think that, to your point, when you make a mistake, it totally undermines like your core identity. It's like, this is my job. This is what I do. It's my career. I am passionate about it. And I am going to work earnestly to do the best I can at it. But at the same time, I know that I will make mistakes. And I know that when I make a mistake, the most important personality attribute is the ability to get back up, dust yourself off, and keep doing it. And so point being that back to the issue and kind of inching toward answering your question of like, what is an appropriate way to handle something like one target is a candidate or one individual is a target for an open position and you know who that group is targeting. So one of the things that got a lot of attention was Ty's comment that this is paraphrasing, but he essentially said it is unprofessional to break news when the subject of the news doesn't have an opportunity to inform his team about the news itself. And I don't fully agree with that. And he and I have spoken about that. He knows that that's my point of view. I think that there are instances in which you come into information that you wouldn't otherwise have because like you just wouldn't have known it or you didn't know it when it was shared with you. And the caveat of it being shared with you is please hold this until we have the opportunity to tell our team. As, you know, a member of the media, you have a choice at that point to agree or say no. In my opinion, it is incredibly improper to say, no, I'm going to go earlier than you want me to, because that's just breaking the agreement upon which the information was shared with you and you knew it. So you can choose not to share it at all or, you know, come up with some circuitous route. But ultimately, like the element of this, and this is where, you know, my time in this space is a huge function of my ability to do this. You know, it's a relationship business and people want to feel comfortable or have to feel comfortable that you're going to treat sensitive information appropriately. Now, I think Chris's point of view is that, and one of the reasons that he does pursue the route that he does with this information sharing is, you know, kind of a core belief that this information can be shared more expediently. And that may be true. In some instances. In other instances, it may not be true. I think that that's a reflection of, you know, some of the scoops he gets versus some of the scoops that he doesn't get. One of the elements of this is, because of the nature of the relationships that we have, I seek first-party confirmation most of the time, right? Now, that doesn't always include every pertinent party, but if I can get confirmation from an individual who is involved in a breaking news situation, then it accomplishes two things. First, it lets them know that a story is coming. And second, it ensures the accuracy of the information. But pursuing confirmation does come at the expense of speed. So essentially, the trade-off is, I think that, and you know, obviously I can speak for myself and to a certain degree, but slightly lesser degree, other Inside Lacrosse staff members, I think our trade-off is that we are less likely to be incorrect and also more likely to be slower, and that is an acceptable outcome relative to what I think, you know, Chris is willing to do by infrequently seeking first-party confirmation, which is more frequently be quick and also more frequently be, at least to some extent, inaccurate. And that brings us all the way back to the question that you asked, which is, what is the appropriate way to phrase what you're talking about? And I remember when Furman had its head coach opening, that ultimately ended in hiring Richie Mead. I had a direct line of communication with a member of the athletic department who supplied me with their candidate list. That is who they had interviewed. I published that candidate list, or reported that candidate list, and one member of the list took issue with his name being included.
Who was it?
I'm not gonna say it, but I will hint at the fact that he recently just got a new job this summer. And I said to him, I was like, well, I can understand why that wouldn't have been good for you, but at the same time, like, I had first-party confirmation that it was accurate. Now, the phrasing is very important. You have to be very precise in the terms that you use in order to avoid a pitfall. And in this scenario, you know, I think the flaw in Chris's tweet was he didn't make it clear that the list was, if it indeed was, the five names that Syracuse preferred or Gary Gate preferred, as opposed to five guys that were interviewing for the job. And, you know, as a sophisticated audience would probably infer that on the basis of the fact that it was only 36 hours after the job opened in the first place. You don't make five calls in 36 hours. I mean, some guys do, but mostly it does not happen that quickly. And so, yeah, I mean, it gets to the point. And I think this isn't the perfect opportunity to kind of transition into what I think is going to be the most interesting element of this, which is your experience with breaking news and then having that called to the carpet publicly. Because I think ultimately to the point of why the process needs to be taken seriously is because they do have real world stakes. You know, Joe Amplo is a head coach with a current roster and he is currently recruiting members of the class of 2025 and he has a contract and employer. And if the public perception is that he is pursuing or interested in another job, that undermines his ability to do his actual job in the moment. Which is why he's incentivized to make it very clear that that is inaccurate. I am not interested in this job. Now, certainly we've seen instances in which coaches have said that and not acted and followed through. I don't think that this is a scenario in which that is going to unfold. But that is why a party who is reported about is invested in making sure that, you know, accuracy and clarity is out there in the world. Which brings us to the post-game podcast's short dalliance with breaking news. And I don't think I've ever told you this, but I think you and I had the same source that told us that Jeff Teat was transferring to Denver. And that source was very, like, strong, right? So you have the floor. And I'm not asking you to burn the source, by the way. I'm just saying that,
I'm 100% going to burn the source. Okay. I am going to light the source on fire. So during the postgame, we broke two pieces of news. The first one, as a current member of the Redwoods, we broke that Pennell was getting traded to the Redwoods. That was potentially the funniest one because while it wasn't as funny because it wasn't just blatantly incorrect, talk about not having journalistic integrity. Like, I was a member of the team. I had information. We had kind of just started the podcast and we're just getting going. And that ruffled some feathers up at the top. And I love to be a little feather ruffler sometimes. And so the reason that one was funny is because we tweeted that one out. And the way that the PLL structures their trades, from my understanding, is a trade happens, whatever, but they want time to like build out the graphics, hype up the announcement, and kind of have like this whole content plan around it. So the thought process that went into that would be like, wouldn't it be funny if we just like tweeted it out? And this was right around the time when some journalist was doing a huge piece on Donald Trump Jr. And Donald Trump Jr. just tweeted out whatever the journalist was working on. And it kind of went viral where it was like, I've been working on this story for 2 years. And he just tweeted it out. And we were like, what if we kind of played that role and just did that? So I had a nice long conversation with Mike Rabel after that about the journalistic integrity of players that are currently on the roster breaking news about the roster itself. So that's a story that we'll dive into another time, because that was just hilarious by all accounts. What we're talking about here is the breaking the Jeff Teat news for Denver. And what Amplo mentioned was inherently correct, where he's like, hope you got the clicks and the views that you were looking for. Breaking wrong news is the best thing that you can do to drive traffic to your website of all time. I think there's a certain law that states the best way to get an answer on the internet is not to ask it, but to state the wrong conclusion. And then everybody will come in and correct you. And that's exactly what we did. So the story of how we were breaking the Jeff Teat news to Denver, this was a time when the Ivy Leagues were like, you know, shutting down and during COVID and everything.
Let me make that clear. So all throughout the winter and into like February, late January, it was unclear whether they were going to play the 2021 season. And so everything was on like, you know, pins and needles or whatever. And then like January 26th or something like that, I remember we reported that they weren't going to play a spring sport season. And so then basically like transfer portal activity kind of kicked into high gear, and you saw a prominent Yale faceoff specialist. Well, first you saw Jackson Morrill and Lucas Kotler transfer to Denver. But because T.D. Erland hadn't, like, he wasn't in the same situation academically because he had transferred in from Albany, like, that kind of created a scenario in and of itself.
Yeah. And so the source that we had was a player that we had interviewed for the podcast. He was at Albany. He went to Yale. Just won gold for the USA. Currently plays for the Toronto Rock, currently plays for the Redwoods. I don't know if I'm narrowing it down again, but
has a brother who played for Cornell at the time. Considering transferring. Yeah.
Yep. From Victor, New York, TD Ireland was our source. And so we had so much fun with the Pinnell trade. And even though I kind of had to take my licks from the top of the PLL, I was like, well, what could go wrong with this one? And the way that he let us know is there was a little bit of rumor mill going, like, Teat's going to transfer. And I wasn't paying attention to college across much, so I didn't know, like, how good Teat was. I didn't know that this would be, like, a huge deal. But TD kind of hinted, hey, Teat might be transferring to Denver. And I'm like, well, who better than a guy from the Ivy League that's transferring to Denver? There's no way that this is going to go wrong. So we didn't even take the time to confirm it. We didn't even ask, are you sure? He said, Teat might be going to Denver. And we're like, Jeff Teat's going to Denver. Like, let's break the news. Let's get all the clout. Journalism is easy. Like, how stupid are these people that do this full time? Like, we got two for two in like a month. Immediately met with massive, massive backlash. And Evan Malloy, my co-host, he knows the coaching staff, or at least is like good friends with one of the Cornell guys. And the Cornell coach texted him and was like, hey, love what you're doing with the post game. Love everything about it. Our week just became shitty because of what you guys tweeted out. And so that immediately became Okay, so maybe we shouldn't be journalists because this is clearly wrong. How do we backtrack from this? How do we do this? How do we do that? So the
Well,
connection that Evan had to Cornell.
Making matters even funnier, though, because on the other side, it wasn't just the Cornell side, but it was also the Jeff side. He's like the quietest kid in the entire world and would never have like really engaged with saying no. He just would have like let it ride and not transferred and it would have died. But didn't you hear from Dan Teat, NLL legend?
Yep. So we had a couple prominent members reach out. And first off, let me say Dan Teat is the man. I've gotten to know him a little bit. I've seen him after some, because he was on the staff for the, Panther City?
Panther City, yeah.
Yeah, Panther City NLL club. That coaching staff was incredible. I would grab a beer with him. Really, really good guy. At the time, I don't think he was the biggest fan of us improperly breaking news about his son. So we had some back and forth exchanges. And bottom line, all of this is to say, like, breaking bad news or news that pisses people off, there's no easier way to get your rocks off on social media attention than to break incorrect news. And the Jeff Teat saga is still one that we think is one of the peak moments of lacrosse Twitter. And let me just say that the lacrosse Twitter is the stupidest place ever. I'm never going to leave it ever. Threads kick rocks, too positive. Twitter is the cesspool that we all need. The spectators of lacrosse Twitter are the biggest idiots of all time. A lot of you follow me. I don't care. You are idiots because you always are like, lacrosse is such a tight-knit community. We're such a really good fan base. Like, it's such a great sport. We got to honor the creator versus how dare could, like, what, you're breaking news? Like, didn't you think about the lacrosse coach's family? It's like, you think, you know, a Woj bomb, he's texting the player, like, hey, do you mind if I break this news? No, he gets a credible source, scoops it. It's part of the territory. And this little arms race between Dan Arestia, Chris Jazz Pastrami, Ty Zanders, I think has been objectively very good for the breaking news industry within lacrosse Twitter. And so these people that just have stupid opinions that not only say lacrosse is small and it needs to grow, ooh, but not like that. I don't like that. Grow up. So, between the Pinnell, people don't talk about the amount of trouble I got in with the Pinnell trade. People very often bring up the amount of trouble we got in with the Teat trade. But it all stems back to TD Ireland. The reason that he told us this was because that he wanted Teat to go to Denver and thought that this would be good to like apply pressure to get him to actually transfer. So that was a great 4D chess move by TD Ireland, where he was like, hey, guess you have to go to Denver now. Like, didn't you see the news? Didn't you see the press about it? Turns out that doesn't exactly weigh into the conversation. But he got me and he got everybody else. So, TD, consider yourself burned as a source.
Well, we're 30 minutes into a discussion about something that has, as we already discussed, a variable amount of intrinsic value. So, Nick, let's move on to talk about
real quick,
how we spent.
Last thing.
Go ahead.
Last thing. In the entire sport of lacrosse, current players, do you think there would be a worse podcast than Jeff Teat and TD Ireland?
If the standard is two guys who say nothing, I think you got to sub Wes Bergen for TD.
No, but you get Wes on the.
That's
Wes
what I'm
will
saying.
Go 1 for 99, and that one will be the longest home run in MLB history. Like, he will lumberjack his way through that podcast episode. Yeah, because we had a bit where we were going to start a podcast with them called The Unseasoned Chicken Breast, and it was going to be Eric Law, Jeff Teat, and TD. Maybe Dan Bucaro in there as well, I think what it was at one point. And yeah, so that's just a nice little chirp at my friends Jeff and TD. So your podcast would suck, and don't start it.
All right. Let's talk about the World Championships. You and I, well, you spent, what, 13 days in San Diego trying to avoid getting a massive sunburn. I went out for the first 5 days and then came back for the last 3.5, roughly. And it was incredible. I mean, there's a lot that we can talk about. Certainly, Brendan O'Neill's performance, 5 goals in the gold medal game is an incredible place to start. But let's not start there. Let's start in a far worse place, which is, what was it like calling, how many games you call, like 25 solo?
I want to say 19 solo games.
That's incredible. What was it like?
You don't have time to focus on how you're doing or if what you're saying is good or bad if you're just like puckered and trying not to shit your pants the entire time. So like, I really think I had an advantage because it's this list of professionals. You know, it's Cooper Perkins, AJ Cannell, Teddy Jenner, Jake Elliott, like all these people that have play-by-play and broadcasting experience. And I'm like, I've been a color analyst for a year and a half. Like, I guess I can do solo games. I need to thank Cooper Perkins right now because I didn't even know how to put together a board. I had an Excel spreadsheet of pronunciations, and that's about all I was going to take into these games. Turns out you need to do a little bit more than that. So solo games are a nightmare. And for everybody who thinks broadcasting is easy, in some instances it is. In other instances, it's not. So picture yourself right now preparing for Czech Republic versus Latvia. It's a bunch of games and a bunch of teams that you've never heard of. And not only are they very, very non-American, non-traditional names, you know, you're doing Latvia versus Korea. It is literally Min Sung Yoon versus, you know, I'm trying to think of a Latvian name that's not Lazda.
Reichs Reiter.
Yeah, Reichs Reiter. And you have to do that. And what was kind of the trickier part was after day one, I only had one game on day one. It was New Zealand, Switzerland. You kind of start to realize the gravity of the situation where, okay, it's kind of funny if you mess up a name, but it's not really. But it's really not funny if this is this kid's Olympics. This is his gold medal game. And even though I'm coming into it like, oh, this is a cool experience for these countries, I wonder if it's going to be USA or Canada. Like, this kid's family is going to clip how I pronounce his name and show it to this guy's grandkids one day as a cool experience. So the incentive to, like, do really well was there. And the pronunciation and this and that. I got to say, Terry, I've rewatched a couple of the games. I think I did a phenomenal job. I think solo broadcasting, when you don't have anyone there to say, hey, Nick, that's actually wrong. Hey, Nick, why don't we reel it in and not be, you know, not talk about this. Just a endless stream of open conscience, dangerous, but a lot of fun. And I think something that I did good at for it being my very first ever time doing play-by-play.
I think that what you just laid out is a good example of why I like hosting a podcast with you. And it's because when people come up to me and say something to the effect of, hey, I really like your podcast. Is Nick as big of an asshole in real life? My response is no.
Yes.
He's got an incredible heart. And I think your motivation and understanding of how you had a responsibility that you had to take seriously because you were producing something that was going to matter to a lot of people and a lot of people who you probably will never encounter ever in your entire life. And that matters. I think that that underpins one of the two reasons that you were well-suited to do the job. The other reason is because you have played a ton of high-level lacrosse and you understand how the game works and how it's supposed to work more than even a lot of the colleagues that you mentioned. Why don't we just quickly talk about how terrible international lacrosse rules are so that we don't have to talk about it anymore and everybody who can complain about it can shut up.
Yep, I briefly mentioned it. So I have I've dabbled with international experience. I went over and coached and played with Team Denmark. I practiced in Denmark. We played a tournament in Sweden. We played a tournament in Croatia. After college, we went to Italy and played Team Italy, Team England, Team Norway. And then the company that I run, Second Slide, we work with Uganda, Mexico, Netherlands, and Denmark. So I objectively know international lacrosse a little bit better, I think, than the American Canadians. Not Americans slash Canadians. I don't think those two people should ever
not
mix.
Not specifically Connor Fields and nobody else.
Not yeah, that whole thing, which we'll talk about in a second. But the international rules are bad. What I don't like is everybody assuming that shot clock implementation is feasible for these international programs. What's interesting is everybody starts with Uganda. Uganda, obviously the only team from Africa, they are going through more logistical hurdles than any other team, I believe. The counterpoint to that is taking a team like Denmark, the team that I know best, it is literally impossible to expect them to be able to implement a shot clock or even know what it is or manage one or implement that into international play. I think international lacrosse is light years behind what a lot of people think the World Lacrosse Championship is. Oh, everybody from Denmark can come out and play in this tournament. No, these are massive sacrifices for every family that's coming out. They're taking time off their job. They're traveling. They're paying a shitload of money. And the practices and the structure of these organizations is very often a group chat of 15 to 25 people that show up to a field and grind their way, keeping this lacrosse dream alive. If you want to save $5,000 to get a shot clock, every team, if you can't afford that, you shouldn't be able to play in the tournament. I think that's incredibly ignorant. And not to sound holier than thou, but it's a very stupid because you're viewing every other country through the lens of America or Canada, which has had the benefit of a decades-long investment into the education infrastructure to where things like a shot clock in your elementary, middle school, high school gym is just an afterthought, as opposed to even thinking about what it takes to have shot clock adoption, rules adoption, and the logistics to keep all of this train momentum going forward alive today.
So I want to affirm your point in one very kind of broad and specific way. There are like 41, well, I think now it's probably down to like 35, but like 35 states in the United States that don't have shot clocks in high school basketball. So think about the infrastructure around basketball in the U.S. and the fact that the majority of high school basketball players do not play with a shot clock. And then try to take all the necessary leaps in order to think about lacrosse in Europe and the idea of implementing a shot clock on fields, etc. That being said, I don't even think that's the primary reason that the rule set is what it is today. I think the primary reason is because World Lacrosse is a member-based organization the way that so many of these bureaucracies are. And in order to create change, you need to build political consensus. And relative to other international governing bodies, World Lacrosse has whatever constraints it has on its resources. It's not in the Olympics, so it has pretty much fewer resources than every international governing body that is in the Olympics and benefits from, you know, the financial infrastructure that underpins that. But the reason that I would push back a little bit on the notion that feasibility is the core reason that there isn't a shot clock in the men's and women's world championship format, the field format, is because there's a new discipline that does have a shot clock. And it's been touted as being more beneficial for international growth and progress. So, you know, those two ideas are a little incongruous. But even still, the point isn't that it's impossible to create a shot clock in all these environments, because you can make an argument that they don't need to be on every field in order for them to be the rule set for tournament competition. It's not ideal, obviously, but you can kind of approximate those conditions with a stopwatch or whatever other means are feasible and necessary in your local community in order to prepare you for the international competition. And then the international competition can institute the rules and the infrastructure that everybody has to play under that creates whatever game it is that you want to create. And that is what's going to happen in sixes, right? Like, the U.S. and Canada will prepare in arenas that have, like, you know, painted lines and shot clocks and everything else. We saw it at USA Lacrosse, etc. And then these other countries that will participate in it will just come and do their best, and they'll figure it out. And some of them will have played on shot clocks on their, with, you know, in arenas with shot clocks in their own, in their home, and some won't, and they'll adjust. But the biggest reason that the rule set is what it currently is because this rule set is 50 years old. And yes, over the course of the last, like, I don't know, 8 years, as lacrosse has developed in the United States and the, you know, pinnacle levels of the sport, be it the college game on the men's and women's side and the PLL, have adopted rule sets that have sped up the game, made it more entertaining, made it more appealing to a television audience. Like, yeah, World Lacrosse could have, during that period of time, spent some of their political capital to modernize the field lacrosse rule sets. But what happened instead is that they spent all of that political capital and all of the time and energy developing sixes. As a result, it is very clear and it is very reasonable to say that world lacrosse leadership, sixes is going to be the fastest discipline of the sport. It will be faster than box lacrosse in some respects. Obviously, you can quibble about that a little bit. But generally speaking, sixes is going to be the fastest discipline of the sport. And as a result, you can infer that world lacrosse leadership wants to see the game played fast. As a result of that, you can infer world lacrosse leadership is not happy or satisfied with the current rule set of the field game. It's just that they understand that bureaucratically, you have to do these things in sequence. There was a lawyer that tweeted at me during the game and was just like, well, why not just for the medal rounds you add a shot clock or change the rules? And I was just like, you're a lawyer. You don't understand how in violation of like how things happen that actually is? Like, you can't just say like, hey, we're a couple days into a tournament and a lot of people don't like what it looks like, so let's just completely change the conditions, the rules of engagement for this event, right? Like, there will be a time when World Lacrosse has the bandwidth to modernize the rule set for its field championship, and in that time, the product will look better. What it will look like, who knows? I have no idea. And how it will get implemented across the world in terms of the infrastructure that's required, etc., I don't know. But, like, this notion that it's like, it's just like, this is a choice, is incorrect. It is not a choice. It is legacy. And the choice was to create a new discipline rather than allocate the energy toward modernizing a discipline that is not going to be in the Olympics. You can disagree with the primary focus of world lacrosse being Olympic inclusion, and you're well within your rights to do that. But the fact is that it is the guiding light of the organization based on executive leadership change or directives. And until that opportunity is extinguished or gained, that is the sole focus. That is the primary focus. It is what it is.
I think that there's not a whole lot I can add to that because you have put together these really nice thoughts. And I'm just like, oh, I wanted to poke a hole and talk smack and make you feel stupid there. But it's a very reasonable point. And, you know, not many people know it's a choice. And to your point, so many people, again, when I say so many people, it's literally Twitter. It's the lowest of the low. But they're like, why can't we just make it faster? And it's like, you just, how do people get so far into the real world? Like, these are adults tweeting this without understanding that you can't change a tournament format halfway through the tournament. What are we doing here? The other thing that I guess we can, you know, this might be a good segue. I thought the one rule change that would be the most beneficial, because if you have a good faceoff guy and a goalie, you have a very good team for the World Lacrosse Championships, because you win the faceoff, you can play that DU stall ball BS ball that they played in 2015, no bias there, where you win the faceoff and then you have a 5-minute possession. And there were some quarters that I would broadcast and I'm like, I don't know if the other teams touch the ball, because it's just been make it, take it. But it's not make it, take it exciting version. It's make it, take it, oh, they scored 2 goals in the quarter and just maintain possession the entire time outside of some ground ball scrums at the top of the box. So I was a proponent, and again, having enjoyed the Sixes tournament more than I care to admit, and I was just spending the week coaching with Eli Gobrecht, Mikey Schlosser, and Romar Dennis, getting their thoughts and hearing like their perspective and Sixes and everything like that. I think Sixes, my favorite rule and the quickness about that was, oh, it's a goal, scoop it up and start pushing the other way. Created for a lot of interesting transition opportunities. If there was one quick put a Band-Aid over a bullet hole to get us through, I think that would be it. Eliminating the faceoff and just having the goalies, you know, be able to send it up the field right after a goal. Let those transition players do what they do. That's my final 2 cents. And speaking of the impact of faceoffs, go ahead.
It's funny because, all right, so The USB Canada 9.6, is that right? Does that sound right?
What, close enough to that to where no one's going to question it.
Yeah, it might have been 9.7. But it's important because here's the thing. Trevor Baptiste and TD Ireland dominated the faceoff X in the gold medal game. And yet, if it weren't for a 5-goal performance from Brendan O'Neill, Canada very well may have won. It's funny because, you know, for everything that we just said about prioritizing change and the World Championships happen once every 4 or in this case 5 years, and when they don't happen in the U.S., you know, the game administration is that of a low-level Division III athletic department, if that, as we saw with the way that the gold medal game in 2018 unfolded at the finish, the stakes are so high and the margins are so low. And in this game, it feels like the margin was very wide. But the point I'm trying to make is that I will sound foolish for arguing that it wasn't. That being said, like, if Brendan O'Neill doesn't sting the top corner and everything that happens from a game flow standpoint that happens after that first goal goes differently, the outcome might be different. And I've gotten an opportunity to talk to a bunch of members of both coaching staffs just on the recruiting trail since Randy Mearns, Taylor Ray, and Joe Amplett were all at our event, and I talked to them about it on Tuesday. And there's, like, you know, lingering disappointment and you know, lingering kind of from the USA standpoint, like we won, but certainly we could have played better. There's an understanding of the size of that margin and what it entails. So, Nick, before we, like, kind of really dive in on the game, what was your overall impression of the U.S. and Canada?
The thing that stuck out to me the most was the American defense and Blaze Reardon separating himself. Jack Kelly's one of the best goalies that I've ever had the fortune of playing with. And, you know, no disrespect to him or any other goalie for that matter, even if it was him versus, you know, the Reardon versus Ward battle. Blaze has just separated himself as far and away the best goalie that is on planet Earth. Like, his lack of ability, his ability to play body goalie while somehow not giving up as many rebounds as a body goalie should is kind of ridiculous. But it really was the American defense that stuck out to me as the peak of the peak tournament. Now, again, when someone asked me how the World Lacrosse Championships went, USA-Canada is the very tail end, because that was my first time there, and it was a really cool celebration of cultures and everything that comes along with it. Getting to watch this USA defense was an absolute joke. Jack Rowlett in particular, I thought, played unbelievably well on a team that I didn't think was built to play against the crafty Canadian two-man game and play against guys like Josh Byrne. So credit to the coaching staff for, I don't know what they did in preparation or how they vetted, but very well done to prepare themselves to play against a lethal Canadian offense. And, you know, even with the slowing down of the game, I thought Canada was going to get 10 two times against America, just because having spent time around box and seeing how truly talented guys, you know, you obviously have the Teats and the Burns, but you look at the rest of the roster, it's like, oh my God, guys, like Ryan Lee coming out of the box, if he's not hurt, you know, you got Westberg, you got Curtis Dixon, who can do things that nobody else on planet Earth can do. So to neutralize not only the Canadian offense, but to make it look easy against pretty decent teams like Australia, we'll talk about England in a little bit, I hope, but watching USA just absolutely destroy England only got that much sweeter after the events that transpired. So my thoughts rely primarily with the American short stick defensive and close defense unit as the, well, what are we even supposed to do? We have a great offense and we can't get anything done.
Yeah. Yeah. So I am going to echo pretty much everything you just said you know, add my layer of detail. So the first is, when it comes to Blaze, like, he played well, but what's crazy is that he could have played a lot better, in my opinion. Like, there were still multiple layers that he could have gone to. I don't think that he really stole the game. And I think that there was a scenario in which, like, had the Canadian offense gotten clicking, that he would have been that last line of defense that would have needed to play well in order for them to win. He didn't even need to play outstanding. He just played a normal Blaze Reardon game. The way that you reacted to Jack Rowlett is the way that I reacted to Jesse Bernhardt. So I think first and foremost, like, got to give credit to JT Giles Harris for playing that role of kind of like the invisible man who just shuts down his matchup and like, whatever. And the reason I bring it up in the context of Bernhard is because, you know, I was talking to, I think I can say it now, Ron Caputo, about what his expectations were for the tournament before the tournament actually started. And, you know, I was of the opinion that JT was the best off-ball defender. And it's kind of a, I think it's kind of like a not that common take because he's so athletic and he's so good at guarding the ball. But like his senior season at Duke really informed my perspective on exactly how good he is at orchestrating his teammates. You know, I think that there's three different off-ball skills at the very least, and there are more, but there are three that like kind of rise above the rest. The first is communication, Eddie Glazner style. The second is space eating, right? So being able to hedge and turn back half dodges without jeopardizing your matchup, or, you know, even if you're that good, and this is where I'll come back to Jesse in a second, like the two adjacents, right? If you can essentially cover three guys and turn back a dodge and support, like you are a next level defender, and not very many people can do that. And then the third is not getting back cut. And, you know, I know that that's like not that common of a thing at the highest levels of the game. So maybe I'm overemphasizing it. But when it comes to USA versus Canada, and you know, this is going to dovetail into my Brennan O'Neill point as well. My perspective on international lacrosse starts from, I remember seeing the 98 game on TV, but I was 14 years old. It has no effect on my whatever. I was in between junior and senior year of college for the 2006 games, and I lived in Cleveland, Ohio, which is like 30 miles away from London, Ontario, as the crow flies. But it would have been like an 8-hour drive to go through Buffalo or Detroit in order to get there. So I didn't go. I remember thinking about it, and I didn't go. But I remember reading all the reaction to it, where, you know, essentially it was the Mike Powell, Ryan Powell, Casey Powell team, Kyle Harrison, all the stars, and it was coached by John Desko. And the big criticism was that they didn't take a faceoff specialist because, you know, they left Paul Canabit at home and Jeff Snyder had such a great game and Canada won, and it totally changed the paradigm for USA lacrosse and how they went about, you know, coaches and roster building and everything that went along with that. So then Mike Pressler gets hired as the U.S. national team coach heading into 2010. And it had always been said that making the U.S. team was harder than winning the gold medal. Well, now, because they hadn't won the gold medal in 2006, you could no longer say that. And Pressler's approach was going to be much different from a roster building standpoint because of the experiences of 2006 as well. So I went to the 2009 tryouts. It was awesome. It was legitimately some of the best lacrosse I've ever seen in my entire life. I got to go to Manchester, England and be in person for that gold medal game, and it was incredible. And just to make this clear, when I talk about Brennan O'Neill, I want to make it clear that my perspective, I think the most important thing that's happened in the last 20 years of international lacrosse is the fact that the U.S. outscored Canada in the fourth quarter of the 2010 gold medal game, and the primary reason for it, in my opinion, was Ned Crotty's youthful legs and energy. I'll come back to it. So then, go to the 2014 tryouts for the U.S. national team. The most notable element of that was how poorly Tom Shriver shot, and as a result, he was not selected for the team. Go to the 2014 World Championship. That, you know, in and of itself was incredible. It really was kind of the I don't want to call it the baseline. I guess it would be better said that like it is when the reputation of Canada playing a rope-a-dope style really got like kind of crystallized. You know, was had an eye on and was kind of closer to the 2017 tryout or the tryout for the 2018 World Championship, but I did not go to Netanya. And then that brings us up to now. So back to the defense and Bernhard. You know, talking to Caputo, I was like, well, you got to put JT on essentially Ryan Lee because, you know, I was very confident that he was going to start at attack alongside Teat for sure. And then, you know, how they used Courier and Dane as, you know, both midfielders or running out of the box or whatever the case may be, you know, was a little bit left to be seen. You know, ultimately they played Bernhard at attack a decent amount, but also not exclusively. So anyway, I remember Ronnie saying, like, no, he has to guard Teat. He has done such a good job of that. That needs to be the primary matchup. And then I was like, all right, well, like, who's the best off-ball defender? And he was like, Jesse Bernhard. And I was like, really? And again, going back to this notion of, like, when you're a long stick midfielder in college, you're going to be guarding the opponent's best dodging midfielder. He's going to be the initiator. When you are doing that, you're not really in a position to get back cut very often. It's very uncommon that the primary initiator is also really good at cutting off ball and catching feeds in order to finish on the doorstep. And if that's the thing that I value most because of the way in which the last four gold medal games have gone, from a USA-Canada standpoint, you can understand how, you know, that wouldn't be the way that I'm thinking about Jesse. Nothing about my perspective on either team or the roster construction for both teams changed more than Jesse Bernhardt is an absolute animal as an off-ball defender. And I really credit the angle that the press box gave us in Snapdragon Stadium for understanding exactly how much of a space eater he was and how intensely he played. I remember there was one moment in the semifinal against Australia where an Australian attackman was holding his stick, not getting him free, not letting him get free and loose. And like, he is such a maniac that I would have thought he would have just punched him. But in reality, but no, he's also a professional and he's a coach and he's been doing this for 15 years and he understands like, no, this is just part of the game. And so like, you know, like his slide is disrupted because, you know, his attackman is holding his stick. Shot goes wide, end line restart, whatever. And then he like just taps the Australian attackman on the back of the helmet and they keep going. And it was just like those two things were so asynchronous, but also so reflective of like why he is such a good player. And then to just wrap a bow on why I think the American defense is the starting point. They really struggled with continuity. You know, Michael Earhart missed a bunch of the early games. Matt Dunn missed a bunch of the middle, you know, a bunch of games in the middle. Earhart and Danny Logan couldn't finish the gold medal game, which put, you know, more pressure on Liam Burns and Jake Richard. So the ability to like kind of rise to the occasion from top to bottom in terms of, you know, whatever it was, the 11-man unit that was actually contributing to getting these stops was really remarkable. And the last thing I'll say is that like Jesse Bernhardt missed the birth of his son in order to be in San Diego. You can imagine how if your teammate makes that sacrifice, the other 22 guys are like, there's no complaining. There is no like, oh man, I wish we could go out for beers tonight, but we can't. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah.
Oh, yeah,
I wish I could have gotten to see the birth of my son. So like, you know, for me, again, that those are kind of the main thoughts. But just to you know, flip it around a little bit from a Canadian standpoint, like, you know, I thought that from a U.S. game plan standpoint, they did a really nice job of putting a long stick on Connor Fields in order to prevent Canada from really trying to rely on the lefty two-man game. This is a point that Dan Kaplan made, and I think it was really astute. They didn't like to get Josh and Teat or Teat and Fields or Josh and Fields into two-man games because they were both getting guarded by long sticks. And as a result, on the other side, you saw a little bit more of Dane Smith, Wes Berg, Big Little. And ultimately, I think, like, you know, one of the elements of this is that, you know, Ryan Lee didn't finish the game. And, you know, Wes Berg didn't have a great shooting night. So I think that those are outcomes that definitely yielded, or those are factors that definitely yield the outcome. You know, at the other end, what's interesting is, you know, when Owen Grant got injured before the tournament started in the last PLL game, his first PLL game, I think people knew that it was a big deal. Patrick Schume comes in and played pretty well, I thought, particularly for like a last minute replacement, but at the same time doesn't have exactly what Owen Grant has, which is the experience of guarding Brennan O'Neill, which he had done to great effect in the quarterfinals of the NCAA, or the first round of the NCAA tournament. So that ultimately put them in one position. I thought that there were some game plan choices that I would have made differently, and I wrote about this before the game started. You know, I think that there are a couple of things that have been shown to affect O'Neill's ability to get going, and particularly get going early, and how important that is. And I can understand if coming away from the gold medal game, you were to say O'Neill was their most dangerous offensive threat. He had three goals, but one was a step down and one was an extra man goal. We're not going to overreact to it. Okay, I get it. That's fine. But at the same time, Tom Schreiber missed a good portion of the middle of the tournament with an injury. And you're very much looking at, like, you can double pull this midfield and pick your poison between Rambo and McArdle in terms of who you want a short stick on the basis of how those guys had played over the course of the tournament. They didn't choose to do that. They guarded O'Neill with a short stick early. I thought that they should have bumped Graham Hasek up to cover him. I know that he's huge. And to some extent, that makes more sense to keep down low. But he is also very used to playing in space, both by virtue of his field and box background. And ultimately, I think that from an O'Neal standpoint, there are two factors that have proven, by virtue of, if you're just going to isolate the Delaware game and the Notre Dame game, being the most significant. The first is a lefty-lefty matchup, right? You know, he has struggled against lefties. And then the second is physicality. Like, get up into him and try to like, he will shoot. So try to get his shots wide. And I think what happens after that is he becomes, he plays as if he dislikes missing the cage more than a lot of other players who are at his level. And so he will shoot less. So when you short stick and don't slide to him, and essentially tempt him to slide, and he is dodging down the lefty alley, and he stings the top far corner on the run, now, that's a recipe for Brandon O'Neal taking 9 shots and scoring 5 goals for the rest of the game. And that's what happened. And I think, again, circling all the way back to the original point, narrow margins, Brandon O'Neal's performance was the sole factor in the outcome, given that if you remove it, it is a very, very, very close game and potentially a Canada win, despite the goalie, the difference in goalie play and faceoff X.
That was the thing. It was like, as what I thought the U.S. and Canada did a good job of, and Quinn even called it out as like a little confusion, I think, was not putting like what your ideal starting offense and sets and locations are, at least consistently throughout the tournament. So they had different guys running out of the box. They were running different lines, doing all different kinds of actions and things like that. So it's fascinating to see that, like, whether it's intentional or whether they lean into and just kind of develop IQ as the game goes on, when O'Neal gets the hot hand, it wouldn't surprise me if throughout the course of the tournament they've seen what he's been able to do, and training prior to the tournament, of course, and go, okay, so push comes to shove, that's the guy that we want to get hot. Especially if they're going to put a shorty on him and let him get hot, he's going to be a guy that's going to win the game. And if I'm trying to game plan a defensive strategy versus America, I try to take away, to the extent that I can, the two-headed monster of Tom Schreiber and Brendan O'Neal. Those are two guys that are going to win the game if you give them the opportunity to do that. So to your point, again, hate to agree with you, the fact that Hossack wasn't on O'Neal, in the fourth quarter, let alone the, third or second quarter, kind of blew my mind, where I was like, this is the guy that, to an extent, I thought one of the shots, I can't remember which one, I was like, sometimes you just hit a great shot and you got to say good job, but we're willing to give that up. By the time he has a hat trick, especially that fourth goal, it's like, what are we doing here, fellas? Let's take away the guy that has the hot hand. And I'm curious what Canada's defensive strategy was, they were going to try and make.
The fourth goal is a good example because, they switched the pole onto him for the third goal. But again, it's disaster relief, right? It's not even damage control. It's beyond that. And this is where Owen Grant's absence particularly becomes acute, because I don't want to call out because I can't remember definitively who it was, but I do know that the pole went under the screen and O'Neal used the space of his matchup going under the screen to use that space to get the shot off. And yeah, I mean, it's a combination of like taking him out of the game early, physicality and whatever. And to finish the point, Seth Tierney called me out for it in the post-game interview, rightfully. Now, that being said, like, I do think that to an extent...
Yeah, get called out, Terry.
The point that I made when the U.S. national team roster came out is at least to some degree misconstrued. So I made a handful of points. The first being that it is the coaching staff's prerogative to ride with who brung them, right? There is so much trust required in the nature of this tournament. It's short, it's intense, it's hard. You don't have a ton of time to prepare. So the built-in trust is hugely important. And Mike Pressler's choice of Matt Zash and Chris Schiller in 2010 is the most significant informing factor. Now, if you lose, then you and your choices were unpopular for whatever reason, then you open yourself up to whatever kind of issues would then subsequently, criticisms would subsequently abound. I fully conceded in December that Brendan O'Neill had the capacity to win this tournament for the U.S. The question we were asked is, what surprised you? And my answer was that they took Brendan O'Neill and not Connor Schellenberger as the lone college player because, for me, Schellenberger is a closer proxy to Ned Crotty. And I have said from the start that my perspective is so informed, in the same way that I think I had a flawed perspective in analyzing this Canada roster on the basis of what I saw in Birmingham last summer and how difficult it was to shake, how potent Currier, Smith, Teat, and Byrne are when they have space and are playing fast and free. It doesn't apply to world across field, right? So that was an overreaction and a mistake and a miscalculation on my part. The point I was making is that I think that that Ned Crotty role is so essential, and I thought Connor Schellenberger was best suited to fill it. Now, in that very narrow interpretation of the question, two factors. The first is, the reason that I have been given for why Schellenberger wasn't selected is because he had a bad tryout. Well, I would argue, number one, Rob Pinnell was not at the initial tryout, so I don't think that tryouts end up being the only factor that determines the roster that gets selected. And number two, Tom Schreiber had a bad tryout in 2013 for the 2014 team, and in retrospect, you can probably make the argument that had he been on the team, it might have reversed the outcome of the game. So those factors go into it. But ultimately, like, it didn't have to be a binary, right? I'm not saying that there are other spots on the roster where you could have said, like, we want O'Neill and Schellenberger. And arguably, that would have been more beneficial to the way in which this team unfolded. Like, they weren't great offensively against England and Australia and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, like, there was a lot of meat left on the bone in terms of this offense's ability to score goals. So that's the last point that I wanted to get off as far as the U.S. and Canada are concerned. Let's do a quick roundup of the non-U.S. Canada stuff. And let's start with you talking about Austin Stotts, because he was the attackman of the tournament and the leading goal scorer and was awesome.
What I love about the way he plays, it's two things. I'll make three points here. The first, his ability to maintain possession as he is literally quadruple teamed by four guys who are not small. Like, I remember it was against Australia. He literally has more than 50% of the defense hounding him, and he just puts his left hand up and just power cradles through it and then throws it behind the back pass. His ability to maintain possession is the best in the world, whether it's box, whether it's field, unbelievable. The second, I love that he just kind of just plays the way that his body is set up. I'm just going to back you down and then just get a shot off. Good luck stopping me. Even when you're in perfect position, when you're getting, and I had very limited experience on the Seals with this, but I've seen it enough at this point. There were a number of times where I distinctly remember, okay, I have a lift check and it's going to disrupt the quality of his shot. He gets the shot off and I just hear tink, and I'm like, well, what am I even supposed to do there? And the third part that I think goes a little unnoticed, at least I noticed it very personally, because the way that the USD stadium was set up, Torero Field, it's the announcer's box, and then there's almost like some very close raised seating bleachers. So you're kind of right on top of the action, like you're overlooking the action. And then on the opposite side, you have standard bleachers. The Haudenosaunee fans were sitting underneath the broadcast booth during Haudenosaunee England, in which I got to call a game with Joe Beninati, which was sick. He's the man. He is a showman. And at one point, you know, the game was 100-0, and Austin scores to make it 101 with 3 minutes left in the fourth quarter. Now, some of you might be answering or asking why, and the answer is that the crowd was giving him a little bit of juice, and so he wanted to put on a show for the fans. And I think that's one of the cool things, is it's this fine balance between they play the game more creatively because the Haudenosaunee is tied more spiritually to the game far and away than any other team. But the second part of it is the fans, the respect, like the juice, the energy. Austin wanted to put on a show, and he did. So when he was throwing 100 fakes and then scored, and the fans, you kind of hear him go, ooh, ah, they want to provide that to the fans because they're doing things that don't elicit, or nobody else is doing things to elicit the oohs, ahs as consistently, as brilliantly, as beautifully as Haudenosaunee, led by Austin Stotts. I thought that was kind of a funny little thing that wasn't talked about enough, was he's killing it, he's doing well, he, you know, all the storylines that come with it. But at the end of the day, him being a showman, and anytime he hears an ooh or an ah, just know that that goalie's in for a rough, rough day. I love the way he plays. I love the fire that he brings. And what a special tournament.
We're bumping up against it here, so I just want to quickly run through a couple of other points, and then I want to give you an opportunity to talk about Japan versus England, because it'll cover the two topics that I think most need to be... one that most needs to be discussed, and the second that I think you most want to discuss. So, quickly, Christian Cucinello, consummate pro, second leading scorer of the tournament, does a great job with the Italian national team. I got an opportunity to see him a couple days later at the at Deamer Class's Best of Class event, and like I said, just, you know, he's got great energy. So, Christian Cucinello has a big fan in me. Logan Ipp, going to be a sophomore at Harvard, was the best player in the Hong Kong China team. He's incredible. He is so good.
He was the best player on the field in most of the games that he was playing in.
Correct. And he had the ability to, by a significant margin, he had the ability to take over games, and was very, he was Chris Paul-esque in his reluctance to do so, with the exception of like the acute moments when it was required in order to win, whether it be a 7-goal margin over Mexico in order to qualify for the knockout round or whatever the case may be. Want to shout out the Puerto Rican national team. I thought they were awesome. Kevin Lewis is the spiritual leader of the team, and he's great. It was really cool to watch Russell Melendez up close. You know, his competitive, his physicality and his competitiveness are the reason that he is such a good player for Johns Hopkins. I know there are more, but I can't call them to mind right now. So with that, Japan versus England, your floor.
Yeah. I like to joke around. I like to do all this. It's probably the most disgusting play I can remember, in the sport of lacrosse. And that includes, every on-field action that I've seen, at least personally, or been involved with whatever was happening at the time. The frustrating part too is this Andrew Baxter kid, absolute scumbag of the highest order. And this was not an isolated incident. As soon as this happened, and when I started getting into it about it on Twitter, he did the same thing to Rob Pinnell. Almost took Rob Pinnell out of the 2018 games. I have a family friend whose cousin is on Team Puerto Rico. When that happened, the father texted me and was like, "This is the same kid that hurt one of my one of my nieces or nephew's teammates. Something has to be done." Now, I don't know what the rules are for international. Don't let him back in the tournament. That's not enough. You can't play once every 5 years. He's on the way out. He has one foot out the door anyways. So I don't quite know what the right approach is. But given the context of it's Japan, who I saw stick around after the game one time, not after the England game, but they were sticking around to clean up the field. They were the sweetheart of the tournament. There's no team more respectful. And given the fact that England's tournament didn't go the way that it went, given the fact that he's arguing with his teammates and coaches as he comes off the field, it's a disgrace to not only the sport, but particularly England lacrosse, that they let this guy be the captain of the team. I think it's absolutely horrific. And I think something more needs to be done than a punishment of international lacrosse sanctions. Would have loved to see him before the tournament was over, because very few times do I play internet tough guy, but I really think that, given the chance, there would have been something that would have boiled up, and whether it was me.
Well, then on that note, I'm very glad you didn't see him before the end of the tournament.
Why? Why not, Terry?
Because you have an opportunity to drive to Bend, Oregon right now, as opposed to, continuing to spend some time in San Diego County Correctional Facility.
Here's what I would have guaranteed. I get in a scrap with him, I win. The whole that GoFundMe would have gotten the bail in about a second.
Well, the other The other tragic side of the story is that it obscures what was an otherwise an incredible tournament for the Japanese national team. And it's a testament to all of the infrastructure that's been built by a bunch of folks about whom a lot has been written and spoken over the last couple of weeks, over the last 30 years. And so Japan lacrosse continues to be on the come up. Obviously, they won a bronze medal in sixes at in Birmingham. And, you know, they proved, I think, with a fifth place finish that that was not an isolated event. And so they'll be, you know, we don't know where, when, what format the 2026, I think they're trying to get back on schedule. It's on the World Lacrosse website, so I'm not bringing any news there. Men's World Championship will be, but, so as a result, like, we don't know if it's going to be a 5-team pool that they're going to be in with the U.S., Canada, Haudenosaunee, and Australians, but either way, the Japanese are can't miss, and, they were so fun to watch. So with that, Nick. We talked about international lacrosse. We talked about breaking news. We didn't talk about PLL. There's a lot going on. Are we going to talk again this summer?
I kind of do, Terry. I would love to. We've been very bad. Things slow down for me. This is my last week of coaching, and I'm burning the candle at both ends where it's like, okay, done with coaching. Now let me go back and rip second slide. We just got our first high school Texas football team, which I'm pumped about. Keller, Texas, joining the second slide squad. So I'm fired up about it. The final point. I'm going to sound like one of those, you know, people that looks like their hair smells bad, college students. The aura and the manifestation and everything, here's to us being wherever the 2026 World Lacrosse Championships are, you as a reporter, me as the marquee, the best play-by-play solo guy. And I don't want USA Canada. Throw me Latvia, Jamaica. Give me the interesting names, the incredible storylines, and let me get to know these teams, because what an honor it was.
Nick, you're the man. Safe travels. We enjoyed it as always. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and review, tell a friend, and he said it. We'll be back at some point, hopefully next week, to talk more Tailgate Podcast.
Love you.
Love you more. Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the Tailgate.